we did not consult with them on this because it is a landmarks review, landmarks board of review case for
so
this.
It doesn't
because it's in the historic, it just goes through landmarks.
Interesting. Because they presumably landmarks has got more historians and fewer of the design professionals that we have on them.
I think they have a fair representation of design.
Then I'm not surprised that they're recommending the 2-to-1 because constantly over the last 20 years it's been, well, the zoning code allows us to do this, and then the commission says, yeah, but you can't. It's not okay. So I, given especially if we can get other bonuses to get up there.
That'll be a key discussion question that we'll work through with the PSC and then eventually to you as to what bonuses are available in historic districts because of this sort of compatibility tension issue. I think that the inclination is to offer inclusionary housing bonuses in the historic districts because we want the affordable housing as part of these developments.
Any other questions about the Alphabet District? Okay. The last one other code item that we've put into the PowerPoint is related to the University of Portland. And I know there was some testimony and questions about that were raised. So we just included a slide here and asked John Cole to come up to the table because he was the campus planner. The two issues that were raised, several issues, but the two that we're talking about here are the building length standard in the campus zone was 100 feet rather than the 200 in the mixed-use zone. So that was one of their comments was, could that be more consistent? They were concerned about future dormitory construction being limited to the 100 feet. And then the second request related to a special setback that was shown on a map, and I'll have John describe that.
Thanks, Eric. John Cole, who worked on this project with the institutions and neighborhood associations, and we did include a series of maps for specific institutions to try to acknowledge some of the development standards that they had achieved through negotiations with the neighborhood associations and the Planning Commission when they got their master plans adopted. And so some of these institutions have a specific map at the end of the 150s chapter, and University of Portland is one of them. That particular map is shown on the overhead behind me, and what it's demonstrating, if you will, is that they had received a 0-foot setback from Willamette Boulevard. Willamette Boulevard has a particularly wide right-of-way, so they were able to convince the Planning Commission that they could build right up to that right-of-way and there would still be enough separation between them and their neighbors, with a couple of exceptions. And they have a couple of soccer fields, practice fields, that front on Willamette Boulevard. And in their master plan, they had committed to not building on those particular soccer fields. But their comments at this point is that the master plan is a 10-year document for them and that the zoning lasts forever. And they do have aspirations to acquire the McCormick Baxter site at some point and then to move some of their athletic fields down towards the river. So in response to that, they've asked that no-build zone, in effect, go away and be replaced by the similar 0-setback, 50-foot height building that the remainder of their campus is subject to. The staff, quite frankly, doesn't have any objection to that and would be happy to make those adjustments if commissioners feel the same way.
Does the Neighborhood Association support that?
That's a good point. The Neighborhood Association has not had an opportunity to weigh in and comment on that request from the university. The other points that they...
But that would be an opportunity during the amendment process. If someone, one of you brings this forward as an amendment, they can then comment on that in November when we...
Right, and if you could just let them know, because they've been very engaged. Thank you.
The similar comments regarding the 100-foot building length, I would mention that there are two building length standards in the campus institution zone. In the CI1 zone, kind of the University of Portland's and the Reed's and the Lewis and Clark's, we've retained the 100-foot maximum building length that exists in the IR zone. In the CI2 zone for the hospitals and for the PCC campuses that are more urban in nature, we've mimicked the mixed-use zone 200-foot building length. So there would need to be some recognition of the University of Portland's design guidelines that do have longer buildings there. And again, they've staff has no objection, but we'll work with the neighborhood association to see what their input is. The University of Portland has also asked for consideration to rezone some properties that they don't own. In the impact mitigation plan, there was an ability for a campus to include properties that were in areas that they anticipated expanding into. PCC Cascade had some blocks to their north that they anticipated they might expand into. And the master plan for the University of Portland included the McCormick Baxter site at the river level and a couple of residential inholdings in their campus that were continue to be owned by private families. And staff is reluctant to accept that particular request from the University of Portland. We do it for a couple of reasons. One of them is it would be inconsistent with our methodology of defining campus boundaries across all the institutions, which was that you had to own the particular property that you were zoning. And the McCormick and Baxter site in particular has a lot of nuance to it, if you will. An industrial property that's going to an EG zone is sort of the least change that we can make to allow it within the campus comprehensive plan map. So we have taken that step. It would be easy for the campus to rezone the property once they acquired it. But right now it's not owned by them. It's caught up in a Superfund site kind of cleanup negotiation between the State Department of Environmental Quality and the owners. And it's just not, I think, the right time for us to go ahead and legislatively rezone that property.
So I want to now transition to parking and transportation demand management. And PBOT staff were here to join for part of this conversation. So Judith Gray from PBOT, who's been working on transportation demand management. I'll start off by just describing some of the parking requirements and how the mixed-use codes and other code changes affect that. This first slide is a description of sort of the situation. As you know, close to transit, there is no parking requirement for commercial uses, but residential uses require parking, and there's a tiered approach for buildings over 30 units. And this is something you established in, I think it was 2013 or 2012. Outside of the close to transit, there's actually a little error on this slide. What it should say is far from transit should be the primary bullet, and then the no parking required for storefront commercial and the small lots are sub-bullets to that. So that's just a correction that I wanted to clarify that essentially the existing CS zone does not require parking for commercial uses if you're far from transit. In the proposed new mixed-use zones, the CS zone's going away, so the proposed new mixed-use zones would translate that to a small site requirement that would exempt commercial uses on small sites and other developments that are on lots under 7,500 square feet. And the logic of that is that those are many of the sites that have zones today that don't require parking. So we were trying to translate the current parking requirements over to the new palette of zones without completely changing the intent of where we were.
Can I ask a question about that with regards to marijuana stores? So I would think most of those are small neighborhood businesses, and yet they're really more like 7-Elevens with people coming and going rather than businesses that just the neighbors would walk to. So have you considered how that might play out?
Those uses are similar to other, they're classified as retail, sales and service, if it's just the dispensary. If it's got a grow operation, then it's also mixed with indoor agriculture, which is different.
The retail.
We have not treated them any different than any other retail environment. In general, our zoning code doesn't break down retail into subtypes for parking.
And what zones are the 7-Elevens and other convenience stores?
It's just retail, sales, and service. So we don't define something called a convenience store. It's the same thing as any kind of retail, sales, and service.
But they had to have parking. I mean, they had a good neighbor agreement, some of them, right?
There is a special provision for good neighbor agreements that's not attached to any particular zone. It's just for that use, but they're allowed in all zones.
Well, look, colleagues, I just wanted to flag this one, and let's discuss it maybe at the marijuana work session on November 8th, because many of the concerns we get at the Office of Neighborhood Involvement is about parking and the fact that the businesses are attracting a lot of people coming and going because there's no on-site consumption. So I think we should think about that. I know it's going to be hard to do it in a content-neutral way, but certainly something to think about.
So that's the basic starting point. We were changing all the zones to a new palette. So we transferred this policy framework that you had established. Excuse my cough. To the new zones, and it looks pretty much the same. Going to the map, this just illustrates where those bus lines are. So you get a sense that the frequent service bus lines really do cover, you know, a large percentage of the mixed-use zones are within that zone where the reduced parking ratios apply. If you were building housing outside of those, an example is there are some small spots, like on Stark Street, for example, that doesn't have a bus that would be required to do parking if you did residential or mixed-use development there, and the ratio would be 1-to-1 in that situation. As opposed to the lower ratios that apply when you're close to transit. The next slide, just a couple other changes that we did recommend. We recommended, as I said, a variety of just reorganizing that section for clarity because we had to translate it to a new palette of zones. We recommended a wider allowance for commercial paid parking in the different zones because that generally is a shared parking use and can be in a more efficient way of parking if you're going to share parking spaces. Commercial parking is one way to do that. Commercial parking had been allowed in the CS zone, which is the most prolific of the mixed-use zones, but it was through this mixed-use project we widened that allowance. We expanded allowance for shared parking in the mixed-use zones, and so that would be a situation where maybe two buildings share parking through an agreement. We established a maximum ratio for residential uses, and the reason we did that is with the introduction of commercial parking as the... we introduced the idea that you can allow commercial parking on spaces that are above what are your minimum requirements. So if you're a residential building that has a minimum of 3 spaces and you build 10, those additional spaces could be operated as commercial parking. And we didn't want to create an incentive for people to build large commercial parking lots in the mixed-use areas, surface parking lots. So a 1.35 ratio is as a maximum for residential uses ensures that we don't get over parking with the residential areas in the interest of commercial uses. And then the most significant thing change was the addition of this required transportation demand management program for mixed-use buildings over 10 units. And Judith is here to talk about that. And she's going to talk about it in terms of step one and step two, because we have an initial step that is what the Planning Commission is recommending now, with the caveat that they would like us to do a step two by 2018.
So before you move on to that, in the shared parking and the allowing commercial spaces, does that include, if it's a business that only runs Monday through Friday, does that include allowing the property owner to rent out the spaces on weekends and evenings? All that, of them?
That's currently allowed through shared parking. What we changed was to broaden the distance for residential uses that are involved with shared parking, so that right now the residential uses had to be on site, and there's currently a shared parking agreement allowance in the code that allows, through agreement, uses to share spaces if their hours are different.
No, I'm talking about renting out the lot, for instance, near the Blazer games, where there wouldn't normally be a shared parking agreement, but on occasion, the entire business puts all of its
right. Spots. The expanded allowance for commercial parking expands the ability to do that, for sure.
And all of them, not just the ones over the required parking.
For residential uses, you would still be required to maintain the residential minimums for the residential uses during those hours. You couldn't double dip that way, but if it's off hours from a commercial use, you could have an agreement that would put it in commercial use in the off hours, yes.
And churches and other faith and institutions could rent out their spaces except when they're...
If they're in these mixed-use zones, there's still a different regime in place with non-mixed-use zones, but in the case of a church that's in a mixed-use zone, this change would apply.
But not in other zones?
It's something we could look at as part of the multifamily code as we move forward on that, and as more broadly with other codes, but this is a mixed-use code change.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the commercial zones. Is that allowed in the commercial zones?
The mixed-use zones are the commercial zones, so that is...
Okay, thanks.
I want to follow up on that excellent question, because it reminded me that Commissioner Novick wasn't PBOT doing some kind of piloting about activating some parking spaces like adjacent to banks and things in commercial districts in the evening?
I think that we actually changed the code to allow for that, didn't we?
To get into any detail, I'd like to ask my colleague Mauricio Leclerc to come up. He's been more involved in the code changes on parking regulations.
So just to frame this point, we've heard from, let's say, restaurants in the inner core that had parking challenges about, could we open up the U.S. Bank parking lot across the street and have that accessible to our customers in the evening? I think that's the code change that Commissioner Novick is referring to.
Good morning. We are for the central city. Yeah, we have, we split the city, I guess, central city and elsewhere. So for the central city, we're allowing that sharing ability, but also in the mixed use, as we mentioned here in the slides, that would be allowed. We also came to you with a proposal for the central east side, a pilot project, and that's working. You adopted it, and that provided the opportunity. Remember, we had an example of the central east side, a bank that could be used for other uses. So that's in the books now. So.
Outside the central city, that's already allowed, the shared parking agreement. It was the central east side where there was a code constraint that you amended that.
On that pilot, I don't want to hijack this because we have a lot to do, but on that pilot, there were some concerns about whether an operator would allow the use, insurance, safety, things like that. Any initial thoughts?
Well, leave it to the operator. What I understand is that there haven't been a lot of people. They had to come to the city, say, I want to do this, and then we would allow it, a very simple one-page form. We haven't received a lot of those, but the opportunity stands.
Mm-hmm. So Judith will come back up and describe the bones of the proposed transportation demand management requirement.
I'm Judith Gray, supervising planner with PBOT, and we are tying the discussion of transportation demand management with parking because really that encompasses all the different ways that people have access to development. The transportation system plan includes a new section on transportation demand management that would apply in two areas, and one of them is in the mixed-use zone. And so transportation demand management really very, very broadly describes all of the different strategies we can use on that demand side of transportation to help relieve some of the capacity constraints. So most typically, it's things like incentives to get people to make it easier for people to choose transit or walking and biking. It could even be also the things to help people avoid traveling during the most congested time period or even avoiding trips. The new section in the TSP, the Transportation System Plan, would apply in the mixed-use zone. And as Eric said, there's, first of all, a step one, which is a pre-approved plan. And the purpose is to make it simple and predictable for developers to know exactly what would be required and not have to come up with a new custom plan. There are three basic elements. The first one is that they would be required to provide their tenants with the equivalent of a one-year transit pass. And that could be changed. We want to be flexible. It could be a one-year pass. It could be 2 6-month passes. It could be monthly. It could also be in the form of bike share or car share. We really want to provide flexibility with that. And we also, it's very important to know that that's a benefit that stays with the development. That's not a fee to the city, but simply it's more an obligation for the developer to provide. In step one, that would be required only with the initial lease up of the building. Although there should be enough flexibility that if a developer provided a set of 3-month passes and they weren't all taken with the first lease up, it would stay with the building so they could give those, you know, to future move-ins if that was
And it would be actual
available.
Buying the tickets and giving them to people rather than giving them money to buy a ticket.
Exactly. That's right. The other piece that it would include would be information and marketing materials, basically similar to the City of Portland Smart Trips program, and also an agreement that they would participate in a survey that we would administer so that we can track the progress of that. That would be step one. And over the next several months, we've already begun a little bit. We'll be just working on developing some of the administrative procedures around that. We want to make it simple, so we'll be working with both active transportation and development review to look at the options for how we can administer those transactions, whether PBOT should help with that, or if there's a third party like a transportation management association, or if there's simply a way that developers can provide that assurance, just to make sure. So we'll have to work that in to the administration. So we have a little bit of administrative work over the next several months. The step two that Eric mentioned and that I've talked with you about in your briefing and the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommends is to go further in something that would go past that initial lease-up of a building, something a little more ongoing. I listed a few of the key scope items. We'd want to make a more direct tie to parking supply and parking management, which is why it belongs here in this section. Explore if there are ways that we can include existing development and not just new development in expanding our transportation demand management program. Identify if there's another program that's appropriate for the central city. So there are several different scope items, and that's work that we would like to undertake in 2017 and have ready for 2018 when the rest of the comp plan becomes takes effect. So that's it for the mixed-use zone. And then I guess I can talk a little bit in the campus institution zone. We also are sort of clarifying by the creation of the CI zone. One of the things it does is move the development process from type 3 into a type 2. And so we really haven't added a new requirement for TDM. TDM programs have been required of campuses and institutions for as long as I've been aware, for decades anyway, usually as part of a master plan or an impact mitigation plan. So now that it's going into a type 2, they are still so unique. Each campus is different in their hospitals and who they're serving and their location and the kinds of hours that they operate. So they'll still need to be providing that sort of a custom TDM plan. So we're trying to provide some clarification on how that would be evaluated, exactly what would be the evaluation required to be components, how we can engage with the neighborhoods as well. So that's work that's in front of you as well, and what we'll be doing over the next several months for that is just working more closely with the stakeholders to clarify those review guidelines and how they might be modified as they come back for renewals of their permitting.
One concern the campuses raised was that we had drafted sort of a point system proposal that would say that you get a certain number of points towards compliance if you do this, that, or the other. And they were saying, well, it looks like if we don't require our employees to pay for parking, for example, there's no way we would reach the required number of points. And we're going to rework that and make it clear that, I mean, they have to present a plan that reaches the goals they say they're going to reach. They should understand that there's certain mechanisms that we kind of know work. So if they include those elements, then it's easier to get approved. If they don't include elements like paying for parking, they still have an opportunity to show, no, here's how we think this is going to work. But it'll take, with the understanding that it'll sort of probably more work on their part to convince us that something that we don't know works will work.
While you're developing that, I would encourage you to look at different rules for during the day versus evening and night workers, where it's just not possible to get jobs on transit. And if you can't bike, you can live on the other side of the city. So I think we need to make sure that we're not penalizing people for having to use a car for evening and night workers.
One thing that distinguishes the campuses from the mixed-use zone is with the campuses, these are custom plans for each institution. So we're not going to dictate that each institution have the same rules. They're going to be the ones proposing their set of rules to us for discretionary review. So I think that is the intent, to provide acknowledgement of their unique situations.
That's right. In fact, one of the things that's new is that this does include evaluation. So every other year they would be participating in a survey. They already do that as part of their DEQ. ECO has a semi-annual survey they conduct. So we're not trying to create a new reporting system, but have them do that. And then tying that to the performance targets on mode splits that are already in the transportation system plan and the comprehensive plan. So they would be evaluated in how they're performing. And like Eric said, and Commissioner Novick, we're not looking at mandating specific strategies, but rather performance.
And that's a good reminder, because the whole point of all this parking discussion and the TDM discussion is, among other things, we have some goals we're trying to achieve with mode split and climate reduction or carbon reduction, and which are, you know, the mode split targets are designed to help us achieve that. We've also discussed in talking about the performance of the transportation system plan that we have to change mode split if we don't all want to be stuck in traffic in 2035. And so there's a couple things driving this. With the mixed use in particular, one of the goals was to change the vehicle ownership rate as well, not just the mode split, but the vehicle ownership rate. And right now about 12% of households in the mixed use buildings are carless, and we, our target was to try and double that over 20 years to 25%. So that's a policy goal that's part of this discussion.
Any other questions?
I also want to just tie this back to testimony. You obviously did get testimony from the campuses on this TDM proposal and Commissioner Novick just alluded to one of their comments. Overall, the comments about the campus zoning were from the colleges and hospitals, I would characterize as lukewarm, but with concerns about how this TDM is going to be implemented. So it's our ongoing interest to work with them on those details over the next 6 months, and then or a year. And then on the mixed use stuff, I would characterize the comments around this into two themes. One group of comments was raising questions about affordability and questioning the minimum parking requirement. We got about 70, 75 letters on that topic. We also got a dozen or so letters supporting the parking requirements. So there was quite a bit of testimony about what we should be doing with parking in mixed use zones. code-related topics we wanted to go over, unless there are others that you wanted to bring up before we move on. Okay, the next topic we wanted to touch on...
So the other one was street vacations.
We'll get to that in the TSP portion. Okay. The next thing we wanted to touch on was the community involvement program. There was a little testimony about that, and I've asked Sarah to come up here and just talk about... working on a number of clarifying amendments to the Title III language that is the chartering language in Title III that establishes the Community Involvement Committee.
And I would characterize this as really just tightening up and increasing the clarity and the specificity of the language to be clearer per sort of questions that are raised about the committee's just rules about things like membership and attendance that really help set clear guidelines for how the committee operates in the city code without going to the level of specifying, you know, the bylaws and things like that. So we've been working with the city attorney's office.
Any other questions about that? Sarah's time with us is short, then.
I'll just note that I have several amendments, and I know they're in progress, so I expect that to be on the list. Thank you.
Okay. Now we want to move to the zoning map topic, so shifting gears into geography and mapping. And like the last time we discussed mapping, we've divided this up into mixed-use, residential, employment, and campus. And we don't have any pre-established presentations, but we do have a whole bunch of slides about specific testimony sites. So we're relying on you a little bit to bring up issues that caught your attention in the testimony, and then we can go to the right slide and give you a little bit more background.
So we want to talk about Fremont?
Sure. Great. So my name, again, is Marty Stockton, and I'm with the district liaison team as well as the city planner. And I'd like to invite Nan Stark, who is the Northeast district liaison, to come up and just fill in any information on just the community dialogue on some of these map changes. And we are going to be going through them by theme if you are interested in working kind of through the map that way. So starting with mixed use, if there are specific ones within Northeast Portland, we can cover those now. And it sounds like specific to the Fremont, are you interested, which?
Well, there was the Saganich
CM2, where we now have CM1.
Okay, so I'll go to the upper Fremont slides then.
So our rationale for where we are and what are your thoughts about the testimony we heard?
So various things going on, but we are hearing from both property owners and the community. Property owners are generally wishing to have their zoning changed from CM1 to CM2, and the community has expressed over this entire process that they want to have a break between the CM1 or between the CM2 and CM1 going east. So we did settle on 44th Ave being sort of the demarcation line, that being two blocks from the big intersection, which is well served by transit. The rest of Fremont Street is not well served by transit, so that was one of the big arguments in the community, that until Fremont gets a higher level of transit service, that the entire street should stay at the lower zoning. You know, there's different arguments. I think it's important to note that everything on the south side of Fremont is new commercial zoning east of 44th. And so we as staff we're looking at keeping that lower because that is a new situation. On the north side, it's been CS, so it's actually a down zone to go to CM1.
So just to walk folks through the map, because we're pretty comfortable with maps, but not everyone is. The way that this map is set up is that it's a bit of a hybrid. So the colors on the map illustrate what the recommended zoning is that the PSC recommended. The line work and the annotation is the existing zoning.
And then
the pink color is the CM1, mm-hmm. with the orange being the CM2.
And then I also just want to note the west side of 41st. That's also, well, actually the whole intersection, parts of it are zoned, are proposed at CM1. Again, the property owners came forward and asked to bump that up to CM2. I think we kind of went back and forth on that. It had to do partly with the original proposal that we were keeping the vintage buildings at the CM1 level. And so the one that's directly east at that intersection is one of those remnants. And so we kept it at CM1. Across the street is a new development. I think, yeah, we've got some pictures of this, don't we? Which, it's not that old. It's built at a lower scale. That doesn't mean that in the future it can change. So I think we're really open to that being, considering that it's a fairly prominent intersection, that it's a reasonable request to bump that up.
There's also a prevailing scale there now.
Exactly.
One perspective that we have been hearing from commercial property owners pretty much citywide is a desire to maintain their existing development entitlements. And so on this map, one thing that is important to point out is that at the on the south side of Fremont, between 40th and roughly about 41st, where the current zoning is storefront commercial, and the proposal is CM1, that is considered a down designation. So there is a loss of entitlement with that change. Similarly, on the north side of Fremont, between 46th to about midway through the Rose City Cemetery, again on the north side, you see that existing CS zone. And then you see the transition from the orange to the pink. There is, within the pink portion, that is also considered a down designation.
So in terms of just...
If we did CM2 for those sites, would that not be a down designation?
That would be an equivalent zone.
Maybe up.
Not within, this area's mixed-use neighborhood, so there would be bonuses allowed within the floor area ratio, but not the height.
Again, just from a larger sort of comp plan perspective, this was not a designated center, so it's more of we have a little more flexibility in terms of the zoning here, in terms of the use of the CM1.
So while we're northeast, you want to talk about some of the others since we've gotten Ann here. The Sandy, the 55th and Sandy issue.
Yeah, this is another request by the property owner, and it just didn't get changed. We did change the designation, but it was basically an oversight that we didn't change the zoning to match. So he just wants to make sure. So there's a property owner. And then right on Sandy is a fire station there.
And,
that's reasonable.
And what was nice about this oversight is it allowed for dialogue between the property owner in the neighborhood association, Rose City Park, and so we do have a letter of testimony in the record from Rose City Park supporting this change.
Another one, while we have Nan up here, that I think some folks have asked me about is the 3300 Williams property.
Yeah, this this is a site that was also changed on the comp plan map to mixed use. It was being held at the residential zoning primarily because it's a vacant site, and we were choosing to keep the existing zoning on vacant properties. However, in this case, the property owner let me know that they have been doing remediation for what was previously there, so it's actually a brownfield site that was a dry cleaner that they do want to redevelop with mixed use. And so rather than make them go through additional hurdles, we're recommending changing that zoning as well.
Do we have input from the neighborhood on that one?
The neighborhood is generally supportive of mixed-use changes. Yeah, that would be Elliot.
What was your recommendation in the Fremont 40th, 50th request? What was your recommendation there? Have one.
Do we have a recommendation on this one?
We're a little bit looking for your judgment call on that one. It could go either way.
I think the recommendation, at least on the west end at the intersection, is that it makes sense to change that to CM2, but it gets a little trickier, you know. And it's property owners who want to change it to the higher designation, and neighborhood association who wants to have some sort of point at which it's going to stay smaller, and maybe over time can, you know, individual property owners can ask for the higher designation through a zoning map process. But again, that's up to you.
I've got some noodling to do at that one myself. I mean, one of the other factors there is it's, you can see it on the map. I mean, it's surrounded by R5. It's not surrounded by R2.5. It's, you really have that issue of the scale of the main street and the scale of the surrounding neighborhood.
Right. Thank you.
It's fascinating sitting on this side of the table, because if we don't talk into our microphones with them on, then the captioning can't hear what we're saying. Okay. And I can. It's a good reminder that we have to consider that.
I guess a process question is just, do you want to go through? We have, you know, a dozen here, and we can go through each one. Or we can do, have you just pull out the ones that you're interested in, and we can make sure and go through all of them with your staff.
I'd actually like to plot through them.
Yeah. While we're north and northeast, another one that folks had asked us questions about was the North Fremont. So going in the other direction, 815 and 705 North Fremont, and this is just east of the corner of Fremont and Mississippi, where Boise Elliott Humboldt School is.
No,
this is PCRI owns one of them at the bend there.
And the Simpson family is the other one.
Correct. So these are both properties that you gave a mixed-use comp plan designation for, and they have requested corresponding zoning.
So several of these are whether you want to give the zoning now and have them not have to go through the hoops and the expense to do that, or whether the hoops and expense are part of the process and you want to be able to have the community weigh in at that time when they actually want to do the improvements. So we have this issue several times throughout both the things we've already recommended and these issues that we brought up here.
And in this case,
you know, we spent the past 2 years telling people if they have an issue, this is the place to deal with it. So I don't feel it's you know, fair to tell them, okay, we spent 2 years on this, we did our thing, and now it's up to you to shoulder it all by yourself. So I feel like this is the train leaving the station. We should put the cars on the train.
And if we don't, then there's an opportunity for neighborhood input. So I'm going to be very much wanting to see from neighborhoods, do they support changing now, and if not, why? What services are not currently present that would make that going through a zone change would then require the traffic lights or the whatever it might be.
Let's keep going.
We're going to transition to Southeast Portland now. And then if I could just ask Joan Fredrickson, the West District Liaison, to be on deck when we transition to the west side of the river.
One that folks have asked us about is we got some testimony from Inner Powell about the zoning, in particular kind of in the Brooklyn neighborhood. There was a couple property owners that expressed concern about that, and the map shows that there. What's happening here is we've got a recommended CE zone from 17th to the river. I think you had a couple different perspectives about what the right thing to do. From staff's perspective, I think we agree that it is a little bit unusual to have CE directly abutting the Central City Plan District, and just north of there is EX, and it's the Clinton Station area. So there probably is some good opportunity this close in. We might not want to be having that with CE zoning.
And just to clarify, the testimony that we received was suggesting that on the south side of Powell, that this be either CM2 or CM3, which again is the medium zone or the large mixed-use zone. The feeling was that the scale with this proposed or the recommended CE versus the CM2 is pretty similar, and so that is the staff recommendation at this time. The CM3, which is the large zone, would really require a bit more of a public conversation. The neighborhood that is affected by this potential amendment is the Brooklyn neighborhood, and if this becomes an amendment, then I will need to be working with them to talk them through this amendment.
Remind me, east of 17th, it's, once we get on the other side of the viaduct and the rail tracks, what is it there? There's a park, obviously. But
there's industrial zoning, and then there's the park. And then there is commercial zoning that is CM2 adjacent to the park. But then as you move away from the park heading eastward, it transitions to CE again. So where there's a farm supply store and the original taco house. And
we held off making large-scale changes there in part because we're waiting to see the outcome of where we end up with the Powell Division transit project and where the stations are there, and we would like to, I think, revisit that corridor when we're more certain about that.
But obviously, when you talk about this site, there's stations already there.
Correct. if there are no more questions about that, the next site that we got some testimony about and you had asked some questions about was the fate of the design overlay zone in Sellwood.
So this testimony, most strongly was from the Smile Neighborhood Association, and their feeling was, just to summarize, and the testimony was pretty eloquent, was that they are a neighborhood center that is receiving tremendous growth and development right now, and they were acknowledging that there are other neighborhood centers on the west side of the river that had received the D overlay within the Southwest Community Plan, specifically Multnomah Village. Another area that has the D overlay because of the Southwest Community Plan and other planning was along McAdam. That is an area that on the comprehensive plan is mixed-use civic corridor, and so it's, I would say, slightly different from our expansion of the D overlay citywide, in that being only within the mixed-use urban center. The Selwood community was very aware of, I would say, those differences to our recommendation on the expansion. So they were just calling that to our attention. Oh, and one other thing on Selwood is that in the 1998 Selwood neighborhood plan, they had received the D overlay on all the residential zones from R2.5 to RH in response to the change that was happening during the late 90s, and also in preparation for the Portland to Milwaukee light rail, specifically in the Northwestmoreland area. So they are very familiar with the D overlay and are just pointing out to us that it's not currently on the mixed-use areas where they're receiving growth now.
I think that, you know, Smile's making a compelling argument, but I wanted to raise a broader question about the design review process, which is that we keep on hearing that it's overburdened and people have too much work and it's slowing things down, et cetera. But as we add more D overlay, how do we think that we're going to be able to keep up with the demand?
Yeah, the expansion of the D overlay is predicated on the project that's going forward now, the design overlay assessment, DOZA project, to re-engineer that process. And so, you know, we've committed to BDS that we want to have that process play out and the results of that in place before we do this expansion. So it is something we need to keep an eye on, the timeline of their process. If they don't get through before the 2018 implementation date, we may need to talk about an extension.
So we have early draft of the consultant's report on that, and that's going to the Development Review Advisory Committee, for example, I think this month. And so we're moving quickly through that. It's going to raise a lot of issues. It's going to require a lot of conversations that Paul Scarlett and I have already started about how do we do this and how do we move it through expeditiously, but also not cause unintended consequences when we re-engineer the whole thing.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
Okay, we have another design overlay request. So we're going to shift over to the intersection of Hawthorne at 50th. This is just a refresher in the comp plan map process. There was an amendment east of 50th to transition from the mixed-use urban center to the mixed-use neighborhood, so that was done, and as well as a transition from the CM2 in the orange to the CM1 in the pink. We have received some additional testimony during this public process. Specifically, Mount Tabor is supportive of the transition from CM2 to CM1, but they would like the inclusion of the D overlay on this, the final end of the Hawthorne corridor at east of 50th. So that is a request from Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association. Where we have the star on the map, we have a commercial property owner that has testified in opposition to the CM1 recommendation. And they are requesting the CM2 zone, which would be the equivalent zone to this storefront commercial. And they did testify in person. Paul Niedergang was the gentleman that testified at one of the hearings. And I would say that the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association is aware of that testimony and has weighed in, and they are staying firm with the recommended CM1.
I thought that the property owner made a reasonable case. Would the comp plan allow that amendment to allow going back to CM2?
Yeah, it's a neighborhood designation there on the comp plan, so you're allowed to have either one or two.
So we'll just keep moving on. So the next area along Chavez and Division, just on the kind of northwest side there, we received about 15 to 18 items of testimony from the community. This is an area that is designated mixed-use urban center on the comprehensive plan map, and has been designated that way. It's been designated for commercial since 1980. It has also been zoned R5 since 1980. So the staff recommendation was that we at least increase the zoning designation to R1 to match the R1 along the Chavez corridor. But this is a case where, again, 15 to 18 community members have said that they would like mixed use at this, and, you know, to describe their rationale, it's, you know, number one, it would allow more housing capacity with the mixed use. And then number two, this is at a very key intersection within Inner Southeast, and where there's two frequent transit lines that intersect the number 4 and the number 75. One other point to point out is that the Planning Sustainability Commission did make this change at the Hawthorne and Chavez intersection, so just north of here. But this was something that was not called out in testimony at the PSC. And so the community is bringing it forward to you now. Okay, Woodstock, tell me when to slow down. Okay, so Woodstock, kind of a similar situation. So this is a mixed-use neighborhood designation, a neighborhood center. And I would say that the area in blue is R1. It does, and that's kind of between, I would say, 50th and about 51st, right before you get to the 52nd intersection at Woodstock. Staff had recommended maintaining the R1 and not going to the CM2 because there is a block of apartment buildings, so existing viable residential properties, and we weren't wanting to necessarily speed things up along this corridor. But there is a testimony received by the property owner just east of 50th. He owns 5 properties there. One property is not in his ownership, and he is asking for the change now. So that's somewhat similar to, I would say, the Chavez and Division situation. Okay. So another flashback to the comprehensive plan map amendment process. The node at 60th and Belmont initially was proposed with a mixed-use dispersed comp plan map designation. And through that process, it was amended to be mixed-use neighborhood, which again allows both the CM1 and the CM2 zoning. So just to acknowledge the development capacity and the surrounding scale of development at this node. And of course, the Belmont bus is a frequent service bus. During the PSC process, the property owner at the northeast corner did make the request to go from CM1 to CM2, and that was granted by the PSC. So I'll end there. Correct. So you can see the pink, and then the orange is the one property.
I know that the neighborhood opposes this, and just looking at the photographs, even a 3-story building would be different, but a 5-story building would be sticking up very
Well, 5 stories would not be allowed in the CM2 here. Only 4 stories would be allowed in the CM2 because it's in a mixed-use neighborhood center and you can't bonus up height.
Right, okay, so 4 stories is right. Still and then quite different from everything around. Is the PSC just proposing the one site, one lot?
At this time, that's correct.
And what's it surrounded by?
It's surrounded by CM1, which is, in this case, there's a series of 1 to 1.5 story commercial storefront buildings.
There is
Is this the site, though, that just south of here in the R2 zone, there's a 10-story apartment building? Is that?
If you look at the upper photo, you can see that there's the marquee assisted living facility, which is also the old Portland Adventist Hospital. It's a quite a